Very good. So, thank you, Liv. Now we're going to start talking about what meditation is and why we do it and how we do it and what happens. But first of all, thank you for organizing this event here in Club Med Box Hill. As you all know, which means club meditation. And I often make the point that meditation should never be thought of as something like going to the dentist, you know, to sort of get your tooth extracted. It's not going for a biopsy. It's not going for training with one AFL club. It's actually nice and easy and pleasant and happy. It's just learning just how to be at peace, how to relax to the max. So first of all, I told this story this morning. That many years ago, I went to a conference on meditation over in Sydney, and there a fellow presenter was Dr. Philip Golden from Stanford University, and he reported some investigations he had done to the power of meditation. And because it was such a wealthy university, that he managed to get funding to do this little test. He took some of the psychology students, gave them credits for participating in this one day of experiments, and he split them randomly in half, and half of them he sent to a meditation retreat for one day, doing meditation, and the other half he sent to a Californian spa where they had massage and hot baths and hot oil and whatever else you get in Californian spas, all for free, university's expense. And he wanted to find out after one day of meditation or one day in a Californian spa, which group was the most relaxed. And having returned to the campus, he gave them the standard psychology test to see how stressed or relaxed they were. And it was just so convincing. There was no doubt about the results. The people who went to the spa were far more relaxed than those who went to do meditation. And it got me asking, they said, well, what the heck, what type of meditation were they doing? And of course, it's not just all meditation is the same. Some meditation can be really scary. When I was just a student looking for any place to do a meditation retreat, I went to a very strict Zen retreat in the north of England. And there, we get up in the morning and the teacher would come behind us with the Zen stick. And if you were a little bit sleepy, if you nodded even a small amount, you get whacked on the back with a Zen stick. You know, I never got whacked with a Zen stick because the guy next to me did, and for the rest of the retreat, I was bowled up and I was so scared. But that is not the way of meditation. In fact, when I was in Hong Kong a few years ago, one of the monks coming over from mainland China, because, you know, the monks, we just talk to one another. We're not separated. We hang out together. We communicate together. One of the monks had just come from mainland China. He said over there, they were doing a retreat like that, and the master just came behind the retreatants, and if they were a bit sleepy, he whacked them with the Zen stick. And then this middle-aged lady, and when she got whacked with the Zen stick, she got out a cell phone and she called the police. And the police came and he took that monk away. He was arrested. You can't do that anymore. It's called assault. But anyway, I don't know why they do that anyway, because it makes no sense to me. Because the way of meditation should not be a way of fear. That would just create more stress. And you would know if it's the real right type of meditation, if it makes you peaceful and happy. It's not just the overcoming of stress. Stress is only one of the first things which you let go of when you meditate. Because if you go on any retreat, do any meditation, and afterwards your friends and colleagues realize that yes, you look much more peaceful, much more happy. Just like this story of a lady, she was an executive from Sydney. She said she had to beg, and she had to grovel from her boss to get the week off to do a meditation retreat over in Perth. She really had to promise, but she came on that retreat for 9 days, and when she got back to her office over in Perth, she sent me this email, and the email said that as soon as I got back into the work, my boss took one look at me, and he said to this girl, "What drug were they giving you in Perth? I don't care what it is, but please bring me back some next time you go." In other words, she looked so peaceful and so happy that even the boss realized that something had changed in her. It wasn't just the stress, it was actually giving a little bit more happiness and peace. So what we learn in meditation, the overcoming stress is only the first part of it. And it's such a simple thing to understand that, you know, why we get stressed out in our modern world. It's nothing to do with how many duties you have to perform. It's actually how you do those duties. So, this is one of the similes which I developed, and it is, how heavy is a cup of tea? And I said this once when I was giving a lecture over in Imperial College in London, the Buddhist group over there. And I said, how heavy is a cup of tea? Now, these are very smart scientists and engineers in Imperial College, one of the top science colleges in London. And somebody put their hand up and they said, that's about 350 grams. And said, that's not what I mean. It's not how heavy it is if you weigh it on a scale. How heavy does it feel? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, my arm starts to ache. After 2 minutes, I will be in pain. After 3 minutes, I will be in agony and a very stupid monk. What should I do when this gets too heavy to hold comfortably? You put it down. You let it go. And you wait as your arm relaxes, as you re-energize. And then when you pick it up afterwards, it actually does feel lighter. If you don't believe me, try this when you get home for yourself. And you will find the only reason why it gets too heavy to hold comfortably is because you don't know how and when to put it down. And that is a simile for the meaning of stress in our modern world. It's not that we have too many things to do. It's nothing to do with how much weight is in your cup. It's always about when we get tired, we don't know how to put it down and take a break and take a rest. Taught that for so many years. This is now on Harvard Business School blog. They teach it at Harvard. They call it an investment of time. So when you're at work, you're working really hard, you get stressed out, you get tired, you'll find that if, say, you're writing an email or you're writing a report, you will notice that the words just don't come up. You can't link paragraphs. You can't innovate. The brain is just worn out. But what happens is too many people, they keep pushing, keep working, instead of learning how to take a break. So if you can take a break, in the middle of your work period, and you just half an hour, meditation, listen to music, going for a walk, whatever it is, when you go back to the computer screen, when you go back to whatever you're writing or doing, you find that the half an hour you spend resting, relaxing, recuperating, then you get 3 hours work done in two of high quality. That's why it's called an investment in time. So first of all, don't be afraid. What our world needs now is productivity. And as you know from that wonderful introduction, you know, from Liv, that I am a very productive monk. I get lots of things done. You build monasteries, write books, give talks, do all sorts of stuff. So I really produce. But honestly, do I look stressed out? Do I look a real mess? Do I look real tight and taut? Of course not. You're relaxed. Because that way you get more things done. So that's the first thing. Learn how to take a rest, relax. So, of course, I've gone to teach in places like Google and Facebook headquarters. They've all got meditation rooms. So is Dell Computing. So is LinkedIn. I went to their Hong Kong offices the other day. All of these people, they realize if you're going to live a productive life, you've got to learn how to relax and let go. Take time out. And if your bosses don't believe in that, remember that every office, you do have what's called the toilets. In the US, they call them rest rooms. You know why they call them rest rooms? It's because you take a rest. So you can go and sit on that in that cubicle, say for half an hour. And when your boss says, where have you been? I say, I've been in the toilet. Why do you spend so long in there? Because I'm constipated. You're not lying, you are constipated, but not down here, up here. And at which point you understand, you know my naughty jokes. It's not that naughty. Look, even anybody knows here, if you want to go to the toilet to do a number two, if you try and push it, what happens? You get piles, hemorrhoids, it hurts, you damage yourself. So when you go there, just relax, let it go. And then you don't spend so much time in there and you're much healthier. Even that is something you should realize. But if you learn how to meditate, it's not just releasing stress, it means you don't have to go to a hemorrhoids checked. Because you know how to let go. Not only that, that if you learn how to relax during the daytime, you get more productive, and also you don't get so tired. Because that's one of the other problems of our modern world. People, they push so hard to try and produce and meet the targets and compete in this very difficult modern world. They have to work so hard to compete that they feel that the only way they can do that is work, 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 very long hours. And by working very long hours, they think they get more done. And you find psychology report after psychology report, working long hours means you don't get much done. Remember when you were at school, you used to have playtime in the morning, playtime in the afternoon, and also lunch as well. That was there for a purpose, not just to get the teachers to relax, but to the kids to relax. You know, just the nature of the brain means you can't just keep working all the time. It does get tired. And when it gets really tired, you can't produce, which is one of the reasons why it's wonderful to be able to know the importance of relaxing and resting and letting go. And if you can do that at work, you go home, and then you're not so tense and tired, and you don't take it out on the ones you love. So one of the other benefits of meditation is you become much more empathetic, much more resilient. You know, sometimes people have these incidences of road rage, and somebody told me that there was, you know, two drivers that were really angry at one another in New York. I didn't know why the cause was, but one was chasing the other, and they finally caught up. You know, one of the cars chasing the others caught up at an intersection, a red light. And so his enemy couldn't move, so he jumped out of his car and he started banging on the window of the person he was angry at. It was very scary for the guy inside. He didn't know whether he was going to break through the window. But fortunately, the light turned to green, and so the guy in the car sped off. And the person trying to break into his car realized what happens when you get stressed out with anger, because he turned around, and because he was so angry and unmindful, he didn't realize he left the keys in the car with the ignition going and the doors open. And you don't do that in the rough parts of New York, because the street kid was already at the wheel and he rushed off and stole the guy's car. So the guy there saw his enemy sort of rushing off and still his car stolen at the same time. To me, sometimes, well, maybe it's not really a good thing to say, but it's karmic reward. He lost his car as well. But what happens is sometimes when you get that sort of so stressed out, the one little thing just makes you break and you get so angry. And what is actually that stress? Imagine that a guitar string or a violin string, when it's stretched at both ends, really tight, a small thing hits it, bing! And it resonates, makes a high-pitched sound. If you loosen the tension on the guitar string, bing, it doesn't make such a high-pitched sound, a low-pitched sound, which doesn't disturb people so much. And if it's got no tension on it at all, anything can hit it, and it doesn't resonate. In other words, the reason why people have no resilience is because they're so tight, they're so stressed out. A small thing really upsets them and sends them over the edge. Which is one of the reasons why, that when we do learn how to relax more, we get far more resilience. We don't get so easily offended. When sometimes, look at me, the way I'm dressed, sometimes it's so easy to try and offend a monk. Sometimes people say to me, said Ajahn, they don't know who I am, and they said, they said to me once, are you a monk? I said, yes. Are you a real monk? Yes. I think so, last time I looked. But on this particular conversation, it was actually on the London Underground. You know, it's nice actually not hiding away so people can't see you. I'm not ashamed of how I dress. So, you know, you dress, you know, in these robes here. They're really comfortable and they're very practical, having robes like this. Because people always tell me, said, aren't you afraid? Aren't you afraid sometimes I travel so much that, you know, you may be sort of traveling over an area such as, you know, Iran or Iraq or Syria or Ukraine. You get shot down by a Buk missile. What would you do, Ajahn Brahm? I said, look, this robe serves many purposes. If I get shot down and the plane disintegrates, this is such a big robe, I just hold the four corners and it acts as a parachute. Number two, he said, but you might land in sort of in the areas controlled by Islamic militants. Then what would you do? He said, very easily, this robe, all I need to do is put a little slit in the side there and it acts as a burqa. No one knows who's inside. So that was my plan. But anyway, I was on this train in London, and they said, are you a monk? Yes, I'm a real monk. So they wanted to know something about meditation. And it's not just lacking resilience, but also through meditation you get these amazing experiences. Because your mind gets so strong, you can actually see things which many other people can't see. So we started talking about reincarnation. They said, what about reincarnation? And it just happened a few weeks before, at one of the retreats in my retreat center, this Italian Buddhist, he came up to me and he said, I've got to tell you about these really weird dreams I've had, you know, when I'm on lots of meditation. And he said, the first dream which I had at night, that I dreamt I was a strand of spaghetti. And strand of spaghetti, what was your second dream? In my second dream, I dreamt I was a piece of ravioli. And I thought, well, what the heck are you doing? And then I got it. I figured it out. He said, you dreamt that you were a piece of spaghetti and then a piece of ravioli. He said, I've got it. You're Italian, you're remembering your past lives.
Ho, ho, ho.
And you know, because I was saying that in the London Underground, if you've ever been on the London Underground, nobody looks at you. At least they pretend not to. They're looking down at their paper, but they're looking. And as soon as I cracked that stupid punchline, that they all, I got the whole tube, you know, the carriage, they were all laughing. That was an incredible achievement. I know the London Underground, to get people to pay attention and create some happiness in their life was wonderful. So also, the meditation also makes you very light-hearted, even like courageous. So what the meditation does, yeah, it does make you get you rid of stress, but it's much more than that. And how it gets rid of stress, because you learn how to relax your body. Now this is an example of how its healing properties, because there's one of the monks in my monastery over in Perth, he had a very bad back, and it was always causing him pain when he was sitting. He went to the doctor, they did him a CT scan, and after the CT scan, the result was he had a genetic deformity of his spine, nothing you could do about it, operations were just too dangerous. They told him just, don't meditate for too long. He said, I'm a monk, that's what I do. It's like telling a cook not to taste the food. So he said, what should I do? So, he had no help from the doctor. But then he learned a little bit about mindfulness. He read a little book about people with similar problems. And it said that you can't do anything to your spine that is deformed, it's genetic deformity. But he said, on either side of your spine, there are muscles, which most people are not aware of. So he asked this monk, started to stroke the muscles on either side of his spine, to stroke them as an exercise every day, until he could become more sensitive to them, until he could feel them without even touching them. It was just making a neural connection. In neuroscience, the more you do things mindfully, the more these connections happen, and then he could feel those muscles without needing to touch them. He became aware of them. The same way that you're aware of your hand or your nose or your butt, he became aware of these muscles, which I'm not aware of because I just don't need to. And then, once he was aware, had mindfulness of them, the next thing was to get the feedback from mindfulness. Bit of trial and error, trying this, trying that, and then he could actually move those muscles. It took him many weeks to learn how to move those muscles on either side of the spine. Once he could do that, it became an exercise regime. Move the muscles half an hour every morning. And of course, the more they were stretched, relaxed, it was called exercise. And then his muscles got stronger and stronger and stronger until now they're so strong, much stronger than the muscles, similar muscles in my back, they're so strong that they totally compensate for the weakness in his spine. The problem has been solved. Because the awareness and the mindfulness, they do give you some abilities over your body to heal problems. And I was telling people this morning about some of the things you can do. When you have that awareness, it's not just relieving stress, it's getting some understanding on how your body works. So, a few years ago, when I have my meals, sometimes I don't know what you put in my bowl. Sometimes I try to ask, but you say, oh no, it's really good for you. Maybe good for you, may not be good for me. And so every now and again you get tummy aches. And we call it, because of monks, we don't choose our food usually, and we call it an occupational hazard. But sometimes that stomach ache gets really bad. On this occasion, it was a full-blown food poisoning. I'm not exaggerating, it was real food poisoning, where you get these really unendurable cramps. Now, where I live over in Perth is in a cave. I was in my cave, no one could hear me. And I was just sitting there trying to be peaceful, and every few, ah! And every few, oh! Ah! And it's really important when you give a public talk to get people, ah! Waking up. So when I do this, people pay attention. Ah! Pay attention. It's a wonderful teaching technique. And so I was, ah! sitting there. And, you know, we're living in forests in remote places. You know, it's just too far to actually to get a doctor, an ambulance to come. By the time they get there, you'll probably be dead. So, but you don't need ambulances. You have other ways of dealing with these problems. So, with this really painful food poisoning, I became aware of those feelings in my gut. And as I was aware of them, I learned how to relax those feelings, to let them be, not try and control them, not trying to get rid of them, but to open the door of my heart to those feelings, letting them be. Because you find if you learn how to relax, let things be, the feeling gets less painful. Little by little, sort of degree by degree, the pain got less painful, less irritating, easier to endure. And it's no exaggeration, 20 minutes it took me to relax those feelings until they totally vanished. And no more screams, no more indigestion. My guts were just as peaceful as if you've had a very nice meal, very healthy, very well cooked, nice and peaceful. That's how I got rid of food poisoning in 20 minutes. Of course, I've been doing this a long time. I know about my body. I know what makes it relax, what makes it tense. And the whole path of meditation is learning how to relax. That is what letting be is. You know that sometimes, and sometimes I ask, because I know enough about science, what the heck is going on? You know, what's the pathology of what I did? Because those were bacteria multiplying, messing around in my stomach, having a rave party in my stomach and my guts, and that's why it was just so painful. And then I thought afterwards, because I imagined the bacteria, because every time I see bacteria, you know, in pictures in The New Scientist or something, I always remember those little blobs, you know, with tentacles all over the place. And I imagine all those blobs having their tentacles all crossed in full lotus, meditating in my digestive tracts. I thought maybe that's what I'd done. I taught my bacteria and microbes to meditate and be peaceful and not cause. So, I don't know if that was true, but anyway, the pain was gone, the difficulty had disappeared. It actually worked. Now I've been teaching that for such a long time to so many people in so many different health crises. Breast cancers. You've got a tumor there somewhere. And you got quiet because it's serious business. What can you do about it? You know, one of the most difficult things is you feel just so at the mercy of other people. And this is, you know, life and death. But you can do something. One thing you can do is when you're aware, you know, of your body, you feel there's something wrong, there's something unbalanced, you can even feel a pain there sometimes. You become aware of it, mindful of it. And then you practice this kindness, this opening the door of your heart, this letting it be. And you get your feedback straight away. You can actually feel the thing getting less irritating, less unbalanced, less painful. The mindfulness allows you to have feedback. And the thing which creates the easing of those pains, irritations, that's what we call letting go. It's otherwise called kindness. Opening the door of your heart, compassion, leaving it alone, making peace with it. Words which are pointing to the same thing. You're welcoming, leaving it alone. And then you find the problem gets less. Whatever makes it get less, more easy to deal with. This is your own physical pain, discomfort, problem. You find that that's called letting go. Because it answers a question which many people ask in meditation. How do you let go? This is where you learn on your own body. You get instant results. It's amazing the sorts of things which you can heal. This, one of those great little emails which I got was from a lady in Poland. and she had severe arthritis. And she said she had to take very heavy medications, just as painkillers, to survive, to get through the day. Have ever you seen people with severe arthritis? You know, the body's crippled and it's really, really, really painful. But the painkillers have very bad side effects. So she listened to me on YouTube. She learned these meditation techniques. And she sent one of these emails, which I will always treasure, saying, "Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I don't need the painkillers anymore because the arthritis is gone." And I don't know if that was possible, but it had gone. You know, she'd managed to be aware of that pain, that feeling in her body, and just to relax it so much that the inflammation which causes the arthritis lessened, 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 lessened until it had vanished. How that happens, I don't know. But certainly I've got lots of doctors, mostly actually in Hong Kong, they're very interested in, you know, finding some research to take this meditation into a much deeper level, so that you can save a lot of problems in our health. But again, it's not just even health, because we also have our emotional health. And the fact that sometimes we are hardly understand ourselves, let alone being able to understand others. So remember, when you have this meditation, now first of all you just learn how to relax your body, then you learn how to relax your mind. And this afternoon or this morning I was talking about just getting this idea of a peaceometer. A peaceometer, just like a speedometer, like a thermometer, which measures things, you can understand how peaceful are you. So right now I ask you, you don't need to shout it out, on a level from 1 to 10, a scale from 1 to 10, how peaceful are you? Number 1 is really peaceful, number 10 is really agitated. How peaceful are you? Give it a number from 1 to 10. Now, what makes that number go up? What makes you more agitated? What makes you more peaceful? What you're learning here is about how your mind gets agitated, how it gets peaceful. Simple things, you know, just like letting go of worry about the future. Worry about the future. Worrying about the future doesn't make bad things happen. So worrying about the future, worrying about the future doesn't stop bad things happening. They will happen anyway, it just stops you enjoying the present moment. That is the great wisdom of Snoopy. That's where I get most of my philosophy from, from the comics. Or even a better one, which I mentioned today, where Charlie Brown was saying, everyone will die one day, which is true, but it's a bit depressing. And Snoopy replied, yes, but most days people don't die. In other words, don't be so negative. And also, you know, you find that when you learn how to relax and not worry, your peaceometer goes down. When you laugh, it goes down. When you learn how to be peaceful and content, it goes down. There's cartoons, another wisdom from cartoons. There was this person, really angry, came to see his monk. And he had a sign, like a protest sign. I want happiness. And he was really upset. And the monk took the sign and said, your first problem, I. Scrub that out. So he scrubbed it out, and then the sign read, want happiness. Your second problem, want. He scrubbed that out. And then the monk put up the sign and said, what does this say? Happiness. Problem solved. The I and the want is the problem. That's why today we are just obsessed with iPhones and iPads. No wonder people are stressed. And have a look, someone asked me, do I have an iPhone? I don't have an iPhone. Have a look at those iPhones. When you see, they're also called cell phones and have bars. They ask the number of bars you've got on your cell phone. Isn't that significant of a prison? Prisons have bars and they're called cells. And it's all about I. But anyway, so it's when you learn how to relax the mind, or as I used to say in Silicon Valley, disconnect to connect. To connect to your peaceometer, how you feel. And after a while you learn the same things which relax the body, letting go, being kind, open the door of your heart, that actually makes you really peaceful. Now something happens when you get really, really still and peaceful. Something which I was really quite surprised about at first. When you get very peaceful in meditation, you get energized. It's like your mind, the human mind, has two parts to it. The first part is the active mind. I call that the doer. It's always thinking, planning, reacting, taking notes, trying to remember things. It always does stuff. And the other half of the mind is a passive mind, the knower. You might just call it mindfulness, awareness, just knowing without reacting or doing. And we are just obsessive doers, always doing stuff. And these days, to meet what we think we need to do, the demands of others, to please our boss, to please our partner, to please our audience, to please myself, I've got to do so much. But when you learn how to do some meditation, the doer gets suppressed. You don't do anything. You just sit here, doing nothing, learning how to let things be. And what happens, because the energy of your mind is not going into doing, it starts to flow into the knower. You start to wake up. Your awareness starts to get energized. You get not just ordinary mindfulness, but powerful mindfulness. And what happens when you get into some nice quiet meditation? It's like taking in a cup of coffee, double strength, but without the agitation. You really get alert. And there's all these wonderful stories about what happens when you get really energized and alert when you meditate. You know, my first meditation retreat had some really good meditation. I was still a student. I had to go for a walk, you know, exercise every morning. I got to this clump of bamboo in the entrance to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens. I couldn't move from there. It was just amazing. It captivated me, the beauty of that clump of bamboo. And all of you who know Chinese watercolors, they always have bamboo in the Chinese watercolors. It's sensuous, the waves, so it bends in the wind. Even the leaves are not really gross leaves, they're just really refined, coming to a point in the end. And they're just amazing. I've never seen such a beautiful clump of bamboo like that in my life. And I used to be with that clump of bamboo for about 50 minutes. I only had an hour. I had to rush back to get my breakfast. And I went back there the next day. And I couldn't have enough of the most beautiful bamboo in the world. And after the retreat was finished and I was back at studies, I decided one afternoon I'm going to go and visit the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world. And I went there on my bicycle. And when I saw that clump of bamboo, I thought, what a miserable species of bamboo that was. It was dirty, it was dry, desiccated, cold. The English climate is not the right place for bamboo. And I said, what happened to the most beautiful bamboo in the world? It was because my mind had lost its energy. It's one of the first time I realized that when you really energize your mind through meditation, through stillness, you get huge amounts of energy and you see so many things which are beautiful. William Blake poem, to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. To see a world in a grain of sand, you have to be very still and energized. Your mindfulness gets so strong. The whole world, a little wild flower. You can look at that for hours and it's incredible. hold infinity in the palm of your hand. Eternity. Should have said the present moment, but present moment didn't rhyme with hour. You can be there, and it's alive. And I can't resist telling my gross story. You're getting gay. You know you can't, I can't resist this. Because I was teaching a retreat over in China Grove, and really getting some nice meditation. Everything was just so beautiful. Just the flowers, the sky was more blue than ever seen before. Everything was just so wonderful, but I couldn't just waste time just looking at the flowers because I had to go to the toilet to do what they call a number two. I think you know what I mean, don't you? And I made this really big mistake. My mistake was to looking at the toilet bowl before I flushed it. Now, I already mentioned that when you get really big energy inside of you, everything looks beautiful. And honestly, this happened. Wow! I've never seen such a beautiful you-know-what ever in my life. The browns, they're not just brown, there's different shades of brown. And just the way they all interact, it was just like a work of art you'd expect to see in the art gallery. And just the way those little balls were put together, it was like some sculpture had mastered the art of like shape and how they interacted and how it was all put together. And then the aroma. Now, it wasn't like these silly aromas, if you get on your toothpaste or on your soap or on people's perfume. This was real. This was rich. This was deep. This showed up the talk of life and recycling and just, wow, this was real. And it was just really blew me away. And I was looking in it going there, wow, wow, wow. And honestly, I really thought, this is no exaggeration, I really thought of picking it up and showing it to my friends. The most beautiful you-know-what I've ever seen in my life. And it was only my training, a lot of training as a monk. I've renounced so much in my life as a monk, let go of so many things. The things which I really liked and enjoyed, you have to let them go as a monk, renouncing, living a simple life. It was only because of that training that I could put my finger on them. I had to think twice. I can't do this. And I eventually, only because of the training and letting go, I could push the button. And the most beautiful you-know-what went out of my life forever. I still look upon that experience with grief, with post-traumatic something syndrome, not stress. But that was actually important. One of my friends who works at CERN on the big atom smasher, finding Higgs bosons, he was saying, because I've got lots of friends in physics, he was saying that answered a really important question to him. What is beauty? Because sometimes we think the beauty is out there, but it's not. It's not in the eye of the beholder, it's in the mind of the beholder. When your mind gets tired, whatever you see is negative. It's not good enough. The skies are not blue enough. It's too windy. It's too cold in Melbourne. It's just people are just too ugly. They're just too selfish. The government is just not good enough. Everything is not good enough. But you know what happens? When you get energized in your mind, everything is beautiful. Your food which you eat is so delicious and tasty. The people you know, it's amazing, there's not the physical beauty, but their kindness and their goodness. When you are energized through meditation, everything you can love and care for. And people know that and they see that, you connect. It just shows you something which you may not have seen before. So your mind gets energized. Everything looks beautiful, which is also one of the reasons that when you start getting into that meditation, the energy, the beauty, just goes into your relationships. You realize instead of changing the world, you learn how to be at peace with yourself. The energy comes up and you see the world in a different way. to see a world in a grain of sand, heaven in a wild flower. The insights you get are just totally different. The sky at night, you don't need to name it and understand it. It's beautiful as it is. You go into the forests. This is one of my favorites, about the fourth or fifth time I told it in these last couple of days. You go into the forest, and the trees which are all bent and crooked and damaged by the storms of life look the most beautiful. The damaged trees belong and are respected. The people you may not agree with are part of the forest of humanity. Welcome. Thank you for being here. Your respect, your love grows naturally, not because you're supposed to, you should. It's just what happens is when you get energized. If it comes to innovation, one of the important things, not just in our economy, but in solving the problems of our world, that innovation comes from stillness. The wisdom born of stillness, the stillness creates the energy of your mind. You can see things which other people haven't, which is one of the reasons why great discoveries don't come through thinking. I was telling somebody this morning that, well, sorry, like yesterday, that one of the great physicists over in Cambridge is a fellow called Brian Josephson, who discovered what they call quantum tunneling and made the foundation of supercomputers. It's called the Josephson Junction. Got a Nobel Prize for that. And the reason I mention it is because he got that insight after he meditated. It was TM, but still, meditation gave him this wonderful new way of looking, innovation. So what actually happens when you really become still and energized? Your mind becomes so powerful. It's like the simile of finding a tower or a mountain in the middle of a jungle. This was a story when, as a 18-year-old, I went to Guatemala, into the Yucatan Peninsula, into the jungles, because I was really fascinated with these great pyramids, you know, built by the Mayan civilization, which totally disappeared. So we had no record of what they were meant to be there for. And in those days, 1969, there was no admission fees, no guards or security. And I just saw a pyramid and just walked up it. No one would stop me. There's only another one person there in this remote part of the jungle, in Tikal. And when I got to the top of that pyramid, straight away, you didn't need to be told what it was there for. For days I'd been traveling in the jungle, a real rainforest. For 3 days I hadn't seen the horizon. And as soon as you got up to the top of that pyramid, you could see to infinity in all directions, with nothing blocking you, nothing interpreting it, nothing saying. And you could see over the jungle where you'd came the night before. In the little town of Flores, I always remember that name, in the middle of a lake, in the middle of the jungle. Beautiful little isolated town. I don't know what it's like now, but it was idyllic in 69. And I could see that, it took me all day to actually to get from Flores to Tikal. But still, and I could see it like a Google Maps. You could see life spread out before you with those powerful still minds. It's as if like you're out of the jungle, out of the world, looking down and seeing just to everywhere in all directions. That was such a good simile for what happens in meditation. The insight and understanding which comes because you have a powerful mind. Things look beautiful, and you also get these wonderful insights. So the sort of things, the insights, the understandings you get, are sometimes things that give you great happiness, great freedom, and huge amounts of understanding. And you come back from those pyramids afterwards, you come down, you get a much greater idea of the meaning of your life. What are you doing here? Why are you doing here? And why are we so critical of ourselves and others? We always want people to live in peace and harmony together. Why is it that people find it so difficult to live together, husbands and wives? So you get wonderful insights from the deep meditation. It's not just about stress. It's learning how not to be afraid, to feel, to be sensitive to one another. And you don't have to be a winner. In fact, being a winner just increases your sense of ego and self. And so I always say, instead of trying to be a winner, it's much better to be a loser. Ajahn Brahm, I've lost so much in my life. I've lost so many possessions, so many friends, so many people I loved, so much freedom to come and go wherever I want. I can't even just leave this room to go and have a nice rest. I've got to be here a bit longer. So many duties. So I am a loser. And when people say, you're a monk, you're a loser, I say, oh, you've understood what I'm here for. Losing is great. Losing all of your anger, all of your grief, all of your desires, all of the things you worry about, losing your concern about the future, losing all of your worries about the past, lose this, lose that, lose everything. Wow, you feel so much free the more you lose. So, losing rocks. Losing is good. So that's one of the reasons why in my meditation book on Sail Outside, in the foreword, I said that this is the Art of Disappearing book. I said, losing is a great thing to do. Don't be a winner, be a loser. And my last piece of advice to all of you, if you want to be happy and free, get lost. Thank you for listening, because my hour is up.